So it's a pleasure to announce the talk from Bhagavatam. And the title is, well, can I read it? Polynomial time, not polynomials?
Polynomial time, not polynomials, or something like that, but it's it's very small. Oh, yeah, here it says so.
Yes.
Good. Okay, thank you. So my talk will follow a handout. Three pages. This is the first page. This is the second page on both sides of the page, and this is the third. You should make sure that you have it. And the first part is an advertisement, and I'll go through it very quickly. And only after that comes the main part of the talk. So the advertisement. I just want to say I've written a program to manipulate things in freely algebras, and since many people here are interested in freely algebras, the program may be useful for others, and hence I'm advertising it. So so here's a quick demo just so that you see what it can do. So first of all, I kind of load the program in, define a few variables, so x, y, and u are Lie words, so those are just generators to be used. And I just declare that I want all series to be shown to degree 6, because the printout is supposed to be readable, but it could be much higher if you wanted. And the program returns, okay, here are the implemented, the keywords that it has, so lots of keywords related to Lie algebras. I won't go through all of them, I'll just move on. So here are a few examples. So I type BCH of XY, hit enter, and the computer prints out the BCH series of X and Y to degree 6. Now, I could have gone up to degree 22, and in as much as I know, this is the highest degree to which the BCH series was ever computed. But then, of course, you will not be able to see anything. It's 190,000 terms or something. And just notice that brackets that I use, upper bracket notation, and it's much more readable, all right? If you do the normal bracket notation on a long expression, you know where the bracket starts. It's very hard to tell where it ends. And here it's completely obvious, right? X bracket Y bracketed on the left with X, bracketed on the right with the bracket of X and Y, bracketed all with X. Okay? Next, so here are the Kashiwara-Verne equations. So if you've seen them before, then the form in which they appear in the books is very similar to actually the form in which they're inputted to the computer. So basically, x plus y, or the Lie series that starts with x plus y minus the BCH of y and x is equal to f and g, f and g, f minus g, where f and g are unknown, and then the adjoint of something, I don't know, something, it doesn't matter because this is not a lecture about BCH series, sorry, about KV. And this is the divergence equation, and again, it looks, if you read it, it's exactly the equation you expect. And I asked the computer to print F and G, and I could have raised the degree to 13, but here it is to degree 6. So this is F, this is G. Mm-hmm. Now, just to be clear, here I didn't enter, what I entered is the equations, and asked the computer to solve the equations, okay? Now, one more thing, so this is a general purpose calculator, so you could use it to do useless things. So for example, I could take the bracket of f and g, and here is the output, or I could take the trace relative to the variable x, if you know what it is, good, if not, it doesn't matter, of f, and here is the answer as a linear combination of cyclic words. So you see this is a bit cyclic, so this is sort of cyclic words here. And the point of it, well, these are meaningless, useless calculations, but the point is that, first of all, I never believe my own calculation until I check them. So if I don't have a general purpose calculator, I have no way of checking them. And second, you make a conjecture. You want to know, is the bracket of f and g perhaps all the coefficients divisible by 29? Well, you print it and you can check, okay? Next, also I should have said that also implemented are tangential derivations and derivations in general, the tangential bracket, the exponential of tangential derivations, and morphisms in general, the divergence functional, the J functional, and the Drinkfeld-Kono Lie algebras. So a few more examples. Dancho and I have an interpretation of Kashiwara-Verne in terms of topology, where the unknown is the value V of a vertex, and it's supposed to satisfy a few topological equations. So basically a Rademeister equation where you can slide a strand under this, and then some unzip equation, and then some another unzip equation. Juji may or may not talk about this in her talks, I don't know. But anyway, here it is, they're set up, the equations are written in more or less the correct language, and I ask the computer to solve the equations, and this is the output. So this is the value of the vertex. It really doesn't matter what the language is, but it's a certain Lie series, and then another Lie series, and then a combination of cyclic words. Okay? This is not the same as the solution of Kashiwara-Verne, because the conversion to a solution of Kashiwara-Verne, while simple algebraic, meaning involving no solving equations, it's still non-trivial. And here it is. So you apply the Euler operator to something, and then, which means multiply every term by its degree, and then apply a certain series in the adjoint, some e to the add minus 1 over add series using the tangential bracket. Anyway, you do it and you get this, and this is supposed to be equal to the Kashiwara-Verne solution from before. And if you look at the handout, hopefully it is. If not, it's very embarrassing. Okay, next, so now I'm solving for an associator. So I, again, declare some initial conditions, and then I write the pentagon equation. Here is the pentagon equation. And again, it's more or less written just as in the books. You can recognize that it's the pentagon equation. And I ask the computer to solve it, and here is the solution to degree 6. And I could have raised the degree to 10, and for all I know, this is the highest it was ever computed. Not that there's much to do with it, but here it is. Next, so again, I can manipulate stuff from associators as I please, or nearly as I please. In particular, there was a certain braid, this one, which Juji and I like to call the buckle, because there is some other interpretation in which it looks like a belt buckle. And it will appear in tomorrow's talk by Juji, but also it appeared in several other talks already, including Pavel's very prominently. And so here is this braid, and I print it only to degree 4. This is what this symbol means, simply because otherwise it will fill the screen, and that's its value. Now, what Juji will tell us, and what follows from other from the work of Alexeyev and Enriquez Torossian, is that from this value, so from the value written here, using various Lie theoretic manipulation, simple-minded Lie theoretic manipulations, which also have topological interpretation, you can compute a solution to the Kashiwara-Verne equations. So again, I do this simple-minded Lie theoretic interpretation, hit enter, and hopefully this again is equal to the Kashiwara-Verne solution. If not, not the Kashiwara-Verne, the vertex. The vertex, which is equivalent to Kashiwara-Verne. So hopefully this is equal to the vertex, and otherwise I'm embarrassed. Okay? And finally, all of this, from my perspective, has a huge application into knot theory, where you put some Lie elements at the crossings of a knot, and then there is a certain free Lie theoretic way of combining them along the edges. And again, I'm not telling you the details, but it's in various lectures that I've given in the past. But anyway, here is the Borromean link written as a collection of crossings. So 2 goes over 4, so 2 goes over 4, and so on. And again, now I do the Lie theoretic multiplications and ask the computer to print the result to degree 5, and here it is. So it's a certain combination of Lie words and cyclic words, and this is an actual knot invariant computed for the Borromean link, and I could have entered equally well any link whatsoever. And one final warning, it's all very fidgety. In other words, I make it look as if it always runs, but the reality is that you need to know what you're doing, it prints error messages, it crashes. So you know, if what you need to do is simple, you can basically follow this. If it's complicated and worthwhile, you have to get in touch with me. Okay? Was this enough for an advertisement? Too much for an advertisement?
I have perhaps one somewhat conceptual question.
Yeah.
I already asked it before, but I think it's important to know, right? You explained that this calculator solves, or this program solves some equations.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, the equation, the pentagon equation for associators.
Yeah.
But the associated equation has many solutions, right? How does it...
It prints messages. In degree 3, it was arbitrarily setting the coefficient written here. I could explain what it means, but it arbitrarily setting it to be 0. So when it doesn't know what to do, it finds a coefficient that's not determined, it arbitrarily sets it to 0 and prints a message. And in fact, you can count these messages, and there is a facility to count these messages, so you actually know how many there are, and you know how many degrees of freedom there are, by just counting, again, if you wish, in an automated way, these messages. But also there is a facility, which I didn't show, to set it to be different. So if I wanted, I could set it to be 17, and then see what the corresponding associator would be. Okay? Or I could set it to be t, you know, a variable. Okay, so now on with my main talk, and first I'll start with the abstract. That's not a typo, so it's a rand composed, combined with an abstract, and this is actually my opinion, which you may or may not like. So, sort of, a lot of mathematics, or one of the prime purposes of mathematics is computation. To compute various things, okay? You already may hate me, but I really think so. You should be aware, we should be aware that the value of things is inversely correlated, I didn't say proportional, just correlated, with their computational complexity. So, you know, real-time algorithms, such as the only ones ever employed by our brains, are linear time, or even constant time. So we walk along the edge of the cliff, you know, we don't wait an exponential amount of time to decide whether the next footstep is in the right place or not, right? It's happening in constant time. And we definitely still don't understand constant or linear time algorithms. Right, because we can't even emulate our own brains. So if you ever discover anything in mathematics that can be done, if you can ever say anything new about polynomial or about linear time algorithms, that's wow with capital W. You know, you deserve a big prize. Okay? If you do something in polynomial time, then it can in practice run, but it can sometimes be slow. If you do something that works for exponential in exponential time, such as everything that I've shown before, right? All these Lie algebraic computations are exponential time. But if you work on exponential time things, then you know they must be beautiful or philosophically compelling if you want to get any attention. But really beautiful and really philosophically compelling. If you want them to survive for the long run. In their exponential time, they must mean something, really mean something. And the slower it is, the less value it has. And you know, if you start dealing with large cardinals, then the value is the philosophical value must be immense to justify things that depend on large cardinals. Okay. Now, we all believe in that. You all believe in that. My ranting is that I believe in it a bit more than others. I tend to feel more strongly about it than others. So anyway, what I want to explain today is about some polynomial time computable not polynomials, and explain that there is probably more and within reach. So it may be hard, but it's extremely valuable. We should do it. But before that, oh, sorry, I should have said it's work in progress. And but even before, I want to give you a more concrete motivation and rant about something else as well. So tangos are underrated. But anyway, here is a tango. So really, I will want invariants of tangos, and I will explain why. But here is what a tango is. So it's a certain piece of a note drawn inside. Well, I've drawn it inside the rectangle. So there is a top and a bottom, but there isn't really a top and a bottom. It could have been a disc. I just happened to draw it in a rectangle. And the components are directed in various ways, but the main thing about them is that they're numbered. So each one has a name. This one is called 1, this one is called 2, this one is called 3, and so on. And then there are two operations that I want you to think about, which apply to tangles. So one is the disjoint union operation. So if you have tangle T1 and tangle T2, you can just put them side by side and you get a new tangle. You can complain that the order of the ends is unspecified here. Complain. It's not important. Next, the other operation, I'll explain why it's not important, okay? But the other operation is the stitching operation. So if I have a single tangle, this is a unary operation. It takes as an input a single tangle that has two strands called A and B, and then the operation MABC stitches the end of A to the beginning of B and calls the resulting new strand C. So you get a strand with one less, sorry, you get a tangle with one less strand, and the list of names, instead of containing A and B, it contains a new name of strand called C. Okay? Now, you can complain that this is a bit underspecified because it's not fully defined, right? Because the end of A must be near the beginning of B for this operation to be defined, right? So either the operation is a bit underspecified, and maybe I should have said a bit more about what the domain of definition is, or tangles are a bit overspecified. Namely, you should be thinking of a bit less information when you think about tangles. And it's actually the latter which is right, and I will explain it later, but for now, simply ignore it. If you wish, pretend that it's always defined. Okay? Good. Now, why tangles? Why are tangles good? So, first of all, they are finitely presented. So, using a single generator, well, or maybe two, right? I'm not distinguishing. So maybe one for the overcrossing and one for the undercrossing. But basically, a single or two generators and the operations I just wrote, you can write any tangle in the world. So the tangles, so using these under these operations, tangles are finitely generated. Why? Well, suppose you wanted to write some complicated tangle, you'd take 7 copies of this symbol, of this generator. So you take 1, 2, 7. Right, and then you'll apply stitching operation, stitch this to this, and the stitching operation specifies what gets stitched to what. So you stitch this to this, you stitch this to this, you stitch this to this, and obviously at the end you get whatever tangle you wanted. So it's finitely generated, and in fact it is also finitely presented, because the Rademeister relations, so you know, this is equal to this can all be can also be written as, you know, a certain stitching of three crossings is equal to a certain other stitching of three crossings. Okay? So it's finitely presented with all the advantages that being finitely presented gives you. In particular, if you want invariants of tangles that are well behaved under these operations, so if you have a target space on which similar operations are defined, and you want an invariant in that target space, all you need to do is to specify the invariant on a single crossing and verify that the operations are satisfied. Oops, I forgot something. The stitching operation satisfies a certain relation which I like to call meta-associativity, because it's a bit like associativity in group multiplication, except it's a combination of unary things. Maybe even before that, the double slash notation means composition going from left to right. So normal composition goes right to left, but I like to compose from left to right, so here's new notation for that. Okay? So this means compose A and B call the result A, and then compose A and C call the result A. So you have three strands in some tangle, A, B, C. They could be tangled, right? But anyway, you compose A to B, and then compose B to C, and clearly the stitch A to B, and then stitch B to C. The resulting thing, which is now called again A. So you stitch the new A to C, and that's clearly the same as doing the stitching first here and then there. So that's sort of a structural relation that has to hold in a target space for such an invariant, and once it holds, you can once it holds, this procedure is independent of the order of stitching, and then it's enough to define an invariant on a crossing and verify the right master moves. Okay. So why else I like tangles? Because it simplifies proofs and computations a great deal. So, you know, if you want to compute a complicated invariant of some complicated knot, so here is a complicated knot, and it has 100 crossings, so it takes 2 to the 100 operations to compute this invariant. So one way you can compute it is you cut it in two, and if you know how to compute invariants of tangles, you compute the invariants of the left half. This takes 2 to the 50 units of time. Then you compute the right half, that's 2 to the 50 again. 2 times 2 to the 50 is way less than 2 to 100. And in fact, you can do even better by cutting each of these in pieces. And then the actual computation is the price you have to pay for gluing. And the price you have to pay for gluing might be high. Okay, so it's not always so trivial, but in principle, this strategy is called divide and conquer, and it's extremely successful when you try to compute things like the Jones polynomial, Hovanov homology, etc. So hence, I like tangles. Okay, and the last reason that I like tangles is because it allows you to do algebraic knot theory. And I have to explain what it is, but before that I have to explain what a reborn knot is. And even before that, what do I mean by algebraic knot theory? So think like algebraic topology. It's not just invariants of spaces, it's also the functoriality of these invariants, how these invariants behave under various operations. So I want a similar thing for knot theory, and let me try to explain why this could be useful. Okay? So, but first I want to tell you a little bit about reborn knots. So what's a reborn knot? So a reborn knot is a knot which can be presented as the boundary of a disk embedded in R3. So here is an example. The knot here is the boundary, well, the disk here is this colorful object, and its boundary, right, if you trace the boundary, you see a knot. So a ribbon knot is a knot that can be presented as the boundary of a disk, but every knot can be presented as the boundary of a disk if you allow singularities, and if you don't allow singularities, then only the unknot is a boundary of a disk. So a ribbon knot is a knot in which you are allowing one type of singularities, but disallowing the other, another type. So what's a singularity? It's where the disk self-intersects. When a disk self-intersects, it self-intersects in a one-dimensional thing, so generically a line. There are two ways such a line can be sort of embedded in the knot. So in this way, or embedded in the disk. So in this way, from the perspective of the part of the disk that's drawn here in blue, the, this part of the disk, the horizontal one, the line goes from a middle, interior point to an interior point. And from the perspective of the part of the disk that's sort of vertical, the line goes from a boundary point to a boundary point. Right? And so that's a ribbon singularity, and it is allowed, and only such singularities appear here. And this is a clasp singularity where, from the perspective of this part of the disk, the one coming from the right, the line goes from an interior point to the boundary, and also from the other side, it goes from an interior point to a boundary. So that's a clasp singularity, and I forbid this. So some knots bound disks with only ribbon singularities, and some don't. And it's actually, generally speaking, very hard to show, to decide which is which. And in fact, there is a very famous open problem about ribbon knots, so this is the ribbon slice conjecture. So a slice knot, here's a new definition, a slice knot is a knot embedded in S3, so embedded in the usual standard three-dimensional space, in such a way that it bounds a disk, that it is the boundary of a disk in the four-dimensional ball, where the disk has no singularities as a subset of the four-dimensional ball. So you can imagine it as a knot drawn on the blackboard, but then there is some disk whose boundary is this knot, but the disk is in a four-dimensional space, and in the four-dimensional space it has no singularities. It's very easy to see that every ribbon knot is slice. Yes. Namely, so suppose you have a ribbon knot like this. You simply take this picture and think of it as, well, this is the disk whose boundary is the knot, and then along every ribbon singularity, you push, well, here you push the red side a bit down or a bit into the four-dimensional space, and the singularity disappeared. And likewise here, you push the green side a little bit into the four-dimensional space, and the singularity disappeared. So every ribbon knot is sliced. You cannot do it here. And it's long been an open problem whether it's an equivalence. And the current wisdom of topologists is that some sliced knots are not ribbon. And in fact, there are potential examples. So here is a potential example. It has 48 crossings, and if ever you want to do anything about it, you must be able to do it quickly, because 48 is a large number for exponential time algorithms. Okay? There is also a Fox-Milner theorem, which says that the Alexander polynomial of a ribbon knot always has a special form. So the Alexander polynomial A of t is always of the form f of t times f of 1 over t. So in principle, if you could show that, so this is known to be a slice knot. If you could show, if you could compute its Alexander polynomial, and you can in fact, because the Alexander polynomial is polynomial time. So if you could, if you would compute the Alexander polynomial of this knot and show that it's not of this form, then you've solved the Ribbon slice conjecture. Because then you know that this is not a Ribbon knot. Unfortunately, this is doomed to fail because the Fox-Born-Mueller theorem also holds for slice knots. So if this is slice, you already know that the Alexander polynomial is of this form. So I'm looking for other invariants that have algebraic properties that will detect non-Ribbon, being not a Ribbon. Okay? Good. So here is a proposed way how to get it, how to get such invariants. So here is, first of all, an alternative definition of Ribbon knots in terms of tangles. So, claim a Ribbon knot is the following thing. So look at tangles that have two n strands, and there are two, so here are two n strands when n is equal to two, so four strands. And there are two ways of producing, well, there are many ways, but in particular, here are two ways of producing smaller tangles out of them. So one way is the upper closure, or I'll call it closure number one, and you get it by stitching at the top, first to second, and third to fourth, and so on, okay? And the second closure operation is you stitch at the bottom, but also at the top with a shift of one, okay? So this is a tangle with n strands in it. I've halved the number of strands, so I have a map closure one from T2n to Tn. And closure 2 is just a single component, but a tangle with just one component where you can close it once more and it's equivalent to a knot. So closure 2 is a one component tangle which is the same as a knot. And now I can define Ribbon knot in terms of tangles. So a Ribbon knot is a knot K for which there is an element of T2n whose closure 2 is k, but whose closure 1 is the unknot. Okay? Maybe I'll tell you what to do with it, but then and then perhaps explain why this is true. Okay? So pretend for a minute that this is true. This means that if you had an invariant z that takes values in some space, I don't know, call it a to n for here, a n for here, and a1 for here, and on which the stitching operations, all of these are stitching operations, so on which the stitching operations are, what do you call it, intertwined, you know, make the right commutative diagrams, then z of the knot will belong to the collection of all CL2s of zetas, where CL1 of zetas is 1, let's pretend 1 is the invariant of the unknot. Okay? So if K is Ribbon, its invariant will belong to this algebraically defined set. If you're lucky, this algebraically defined set is a true subset of the potential target space. And then if you take a knot and compute it in its invariant and it is not in this subset, then you know it's not Ribbon and possibly you've found a counterexample for this famous open problem. Okay? So that's why I care. Okay? Now, so why is this, should I show you why this statement is true or rush forward? It's I'll show you one direction. It's kind of cool. Is it okay?
Yeah.
So I'll show one direction. So suppose I have a tangle. Maybe even before showing one direction, I'll show an example. So this tangle is an example. If I close it at the top, at the two tops, then it becomes the unknot, right? Because you can, it's a bit hard to visualize, but the beginning is clear. You can sort of, if I close it at the top, you can sort of slurp this in, like pulling your tongue in, and slurp this in, and after you do that, you can see that everything else collapses. On the other hand, if you close it at the bottom like this, and at the bottom like this, what have I done? Oh, then you can do some slurping. Wait. Did I mess up? Oh, sorry. Wait. Actually, what was it supposed to be?
You want to do SAP.
What? Sorry?
You want to do SAP. You did
yeah, did I blunder? So if I close it at the bottom, well, yeah, okay, sorry, so maybe I should, if you close it at the bottom.
The key point, you have to close it at the top, and then it's not that.
And then also in the middle at the top, oh yeah, then it's not trivial. Yeah, it's clearly not trivial. Sorry, you can slurp some, but not all the way. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, so back again, why is this theorem true? So suppose I have a tangle, six strands, let's do it. So here is a six-strand tangle, so that when I close it at the top, it's trivial. So when I close it this way, it's trivial. What does it mean that it's trivial? It means that I can find a disk whose boundary is this, and another disk whose boundary is this, and another disk whose boundary is that, so that these disks are entirely disjoint and non-self-intersecting, so that I can slide everything out along these disks. Remember, in the middle there is a mess here. I mean, I'm not showing the mess, but there could be a mess in the middle. Now, this tangle is trivial after I've closed. So in fact, these disks might have, you know, parts, membranes, that sort of go in between those tops. I mean, I'm not showing how messy it is, but it could be messy. So the triviality of CL2 means the existence of these disks. Now, how do I get CL1 from CL2? Okay, first of all, I close at the bottom, or I stitch at the bottom, which means that I stitch here, and I can put an extra, I can extend the disk by a bit here. I mean, these stitching are happening sort of outside of the tangle, so I can extend this trivially. But then, I need to sort of undo the present stitching, and redo it in a different way. And here's a lovely way to do it. Just find a path connecting from here to here, and a path connecting from here to here, and replace every such path by a pair of parallel strands. So here is a pair of parallel strands, and here's a pair of parallel strands. And if you look at this picture, it's exactly the other stitching, or the closure to a knot of the other stitching. Right? Because now this got connected to this, this got connected to that, and the last one is just the last trivial closure. Okay? But now I can fill in these bridges with bands, and overall, before I had three disks, now I have a single disk, because the three disks got connected with bands. But this disk is self-intersecting because these bands might be going through the ribbons, the membranes that were passing here before. But when they go through them, they go in ribbon singularities.
Why?
Because this is an infinitesimal picture. You had a membrane and a red line puncturing through it, and I've thickened it a bit. So it's just it's precisely the ribbon singularity. So I've proven one direction. I've proven that any knot that satisfies this condition is ribbon, and you'll have to believe me about the other direction. Everybody still happy? Good. So I have a note here to do a blackboard assay on genus. So you see, sort of algebraic knot theory, basically what I'm telling you is that there are interesting properties of ordinary knots that are defined in terms of tangles, that can be defined in terms of algebraic operations on tangles. Okay? So one is this ribbon property, but there is also something about genus of knots. So I want to tell you in 1 minute what are knots of genus 3. So the standard definition of a knot of genus 3 is, well, a knot is a knot is, okay, the first thing is the statement that every knot is the boundary of a surface with no singularities. If you try to present it as the boundary of a disk, it will have singularities, but you can find a higher genus knot, a surface whose boundary is this knot without singularities. Okay. For example, the trefoil knot is the boundary of the surface that you get by sort of looking at sort of the plane minus the knot in this inner triangle, and then connecting them with three twisted bands. One twisted band here, one twisted band here, one twisted band here. The result is a surface. It goes to infinity, but let's compactify. The result is a surface whose boundary is the trefoil knot. It is non-singular, and with some effort you can recognize it to be a surface of genus 1. So we say that the trefoil is a knot of genus 1. The minimal genus of a knot, of a surface whose boundary is the knot, is the genus of the knot. Okay? So here is an alternative description of all knots of genus less than or equal to 2. So take a tangle whose skeleton looks like this. So this is a tangle. This thing is tangled. Okay, it's messed up in some way. I've drawn it as a relatively simple tangle, but think of it as a, but it could be more complicated. Okay? Now, take in this tangle, apply an operation that I did not previously describe, but you may want to add it to your algebra. It's the cabling operation. So I used it, but not as an algebraic operation. I used it sort of as a temporary thing within the proof, but now do the same, but as an operation from tangles to tangles. So turn this tangle with 4 strands into a tangle with 8 strands by replacing every such bridge with a pair of parallel bridges. Okay? Now, each such pair of parallel strands. Now, each such pair of parallel strands bounds a little band. Is the boundary of a little band, and these bands do not touch each other because the original red strings did not touch each other. Now, stitch this to this, 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 and the result is the boundary of this disk union all of these bounds, and that's a genus 2 surface. So I've described the genus 2 surface, and it's easy to show that all surfaces of genus, all knots of genus less than or equal to 2 arise in this way. So that's an algebraic description of knots of genus less than or equal to 2, in terms of tangles and further operations that I will not discuss today, and it's this operation. You replace a single strand by a pair of parallel ones. So the reason I am discussing it, even though I shouldn't, is because this is the Kashiwara-Verne conjecture. So the Kashiwara-Verne this strand is kind of carrying the weight of two. If this one is called X and this one is called Y, then this one sort of represents X plus Y. I'm doing it completely informally, but everything that I do stands for rigorous mathematics. Okay? Now, if you have a crossing here, it becomes a pair of crossings here. Here, you would call this crossing e to the x plus y. Here, you would call this crossing e to the x, e to the y. Generally speaking, these are different. And the Kashiwara-Verne conjecture tells you how to go from one to the other. Okay? And it is exactly the thing you need to do to go from here to here. So when you go through the whole machine and you translate it to knot theory, the Kashiwara-Verne conjecture becomes the price you have to pay for cabling. And once you know this price, you can turn cabling into, again, an intertwiner, and you get algebraic handle on genus. Okay? So from my perspective, this is Kashiwara-Verne. Or this is a big chunk of Kashiwara-Verne. I will not say anything further about it now, unless you ask. Okay. Can I move on? Okay. So, theorem one. So, there exists an invariant Z0 defined on pure frame. So framed is just a sort of a minor thing. All the strands have to be, well, framed, whatever that is. S components, so it's tangles with S components, where S is a set of labels, and with values in the following set. So first of all, let R be R sub S, be the ring of rational functions in variables corresponding to the labels of the tangle. Okay? And then the invariant is valued in the ring, so a scalar in that ring, times S by S matrices with values in that ring. Okay? And this invariant has the following behavior under connected sum and stitching. So it intertwines the following operations on this space. Namely, suppose I have one tangle and its invariant is this. So let me explain how to read it. So tangle number one will have set of names for strands, S1. So I write S1 as a row here and also as a column here, and then A1 is an n by n matrix. So this is the matrix part of the invariant. And omega 1 is the scalar part of the invariant, and I'll write it here. So suppose I have two such gadgets, the disjoint union will turn it into, when you take the block diagonal sum of the two matrices, while taking the union of the sets of labels, so of course the sets of labels have to be disjoint, otherwise it doesn't make sense, and you multiply the scalar part, okay? And next, I have to tell you how to stitch. So suppose I have a tangle, I want to apply the stitching operation A, B to C. So suppose I have a tangle that has a strand A and a strand B. So now S here stands for all the other strands. So A and B are single labels, and S is a row of n minus 2 labels. So the matrix part has columns A, B, and the rest, and rows A, B, and the rest. And then the matrix itself will be a matrix alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and all of these are scalars. And then theta is really a row of all things whose sort of on the left are A, on the top are S, and you can tell it's a row because it has a horizontal line in the middle. And likewise, you can tell that epsilon is a row because it has a horizontal line, phi is a column of extra things, psi is a column of extra things, and this is a big N minus 2 by N minus 2 block. Very easy to remember. Okay? Now, what does stitching do to it? So, it does the following. First of all, the two variables, TA and TB, should disappear. Because the strands A and B disappear after I stitch. So, you replace TA and TB by TC. You identify the two variables and call the new variables TC. Second, you set mu to be 1 minus beta, where beta is this entry. Here. And then, you get a new scalar matrix combination as given here. And it's again a matrix with a row label C, sorry, a column label C and a row label C, and then the rest are remaining. But the matrix is entirely changed. Okay? And if you look at this, so gamma was a scalar plus a times a scalar divided by a scalar, that's again a scalar. But here you are looking at a row plus a scalar times a row divided by a scalar, so it's still a row, so you can put it here. And this is a block, and this is a row, a column times a row, so it's again a block. So everything makes sense, basically. So that's the stitching operation. And furthermore, to define the invariant, I also need to tell you what it is on the generators. I also told you what it is on the empty strand, even though it's unnecessary. But on the overcrossing, it is given by this silly matrix. On the over and under crossings, it is given by this scalar part 1 and then this silly matrix here with plus or minus 1, with powers plus or minus 1 here. Okay? Yes?
But what does a pure mean? In the domain of V0, you have written pure frame numbers.
Oh, a pure mean no closed components.
Okay.
Tangle. Everything is just no closed components. Thanks.
This matrix is divided. It's just the only way that satisfies these relations and meta associativity relations.
No, I'm not claiming this is the only invariant in the world. It's only the only one. It's not even the only one I know, but it's the one that I'm going to talk about in the next 10 minutes, or even more. Okay? But it's not the only one. Definitely not.
Just a choice.
But yeah, it's a choice. But it's not easy to come up with such formulas. You're welcome to try.
From where this?
Yes, I will, but it will be later. Okay? But first of all, I want to say a few things about... So, right, at the moment, these are just sort of crazy formulas. But let me explain... I want to say a few things about them. So, first of all, the stitching part is... the matrix part, not the scalar part. But the matrix part is sort of known. It's a stitching formula. That stitching formula was not known, but the value was known. It's the Burau and Gassner invariant, whatever that is. Second, the scalar part, when you restrict your attention to to tangles with just one component, which are the same as knots, the scalar part is just the Alexander polynomial. Without details, you can read off the multivariable Alexander out of it. If you know what it is, good. If not, it really doesn't matter. Okay? Here is a good point. This is the fastest algorithm to compute the Alexander polynomial. So, if you want to compute the Alexander polynomial, all you have to do is to, well, present your knot, as a union of crossings. This is a 2x2 matrix, this is a 2x2 matrix, this is a 2x2 matrix. Then you stitch this to this, stitch this to that, and these are all relatively simple-minded operations on matrices, and you perform all of these operations, and without detail, it's fast. So, Nathan Danfield heard my talk about it, so I, I, uh, a few few weeks ago I gave such a similar talk in Aarhus, and I gave an abstract reason why it should be faster than anything else. And Nathan Danfield programmed it and ran it on knots with up to 1,000 crossings, and indeed it is faster than anything else on large knots, by a big factor. Okay. So, next, so there are formulas for strand deletion, how to delete a strand, right? It wasn't a part of my structure, but it's, there are formulas for that as well. There are formulas for reversing a strand, and there is a formula for doubling a strand. And this is essentially Kashiwara-Verne restricted to this case, which is actually just the two-dimensional Lie algebra, to be honest. Okay, so it's a very trivial part of Kashiwara-Verne, a very easy part. Okay, and here is an important thing. So, you know, typical algorithms to compute the Alexander polynomial go as follows. You take your knot, it's a big knot, 1,000 crossings. You, in a completely reasonable way, you turn it into a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, and then you compute the determinant of the 1,000 by 1,000 matrix. So the turning it into the 1,000 by 1,000 matrix is completely reasonable. But the computation of the determinant of a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix is essentially a blind process. You turn your eye, you shut your eyes, you put it into the computer, and after many hours, you get an answer. And the answer is computed via algorithms that have nothing to do with topology. Okay? Whereas this computation this algorithm breaks the computation into sort of many, many stepping stones, where the hop from each one to the next is these meaningful, meaningless formulas, but they are relatively easy. They're meaningless, but they're much easier than computing a determinant. And on each stepping stone, on each intermediate step along the way, this is Tomotaro Otsuki and Misha Polyak, so on each intermediate step along the way, they see the invariant of something. Maybe that thing is a tangle, but it's the invariant of something. It's something that has a meaning. So this is especially important if you care about categorification. So if you sort of believe that every knot invariant or, you know, many knot invariants can be categorified, then categorifying determinants is in an algebraic way is very difficult. But if you believe that many things should be categorified, then there should be a categorification of the intermediate steps, and then the steps that you have to follow are relatively easy. So there is a chance here. Okay, I'll move on. Well, it extends and it is more naturally defined on V tangles and W tangles, but I will explain this later. And the last point is that everything fits in one column, I'm still on one column, including propaganda, which I've already given. All of my, the talk was so far just entirely propaganda, right? So, including propaganda and the computer implementation. So maybe I'll talk about the computer implementation very briefly after the break, and after that, I will tell you where it's all coming from and where else it will go. Okay? So, thank you.
Questions or comments at this point? Okay. If not, let's have a 10-minute break.